This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America on this edition of the program. It's time for an update on sub-Saharan Africa with our veteran panelists, Judd Devermont and Joshua Meservey. We focus this week on Ethiopian politics, including the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, also known as the GERD, and China's spying on the continent. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Controversy continues to swirl around GERD, Africa's largest hydropower facility, which also involves neighboring Sudan and Egypt. According to a recent article by Robbie Gramer in Foreign Policy magazine, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, quote, has approved a plan to halt U.S. foreign assistance to Ethiopia as the Trump administration attempts to mediate a dispute with Egypt and Sudan over Ethiopia's construction of GERD on the Nile River, close quote. According to the article, withholding of assistance could affect up to, quote, nearly $130 million in U.S. foreign aid and fuel tensions in the relationship between Washington and Addis Ababa, close quote. The article indicates that some Ethiopian officials are concerned that the Trump administration is abdicating its impartial brokering role and taking Egypt's side in the dispute. We will also talk about how Beijing has built an extensive surveillance network in Africa. According to extensive research by Joshua Meservey, our panelist on this program, Chinese companies have constructed or renovated at least 186 sensitive African government buildings, which serve as vectors for Chinese spying. He says Beijing is likely to use surveillance to try to benefit its companies competing for contracts, spy on U.S. officials, and try to influence African officials. And joining us to analyze what's going on with the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam negotiations and China's nefarious interference in the continent are our two regular regional experts. Judd Devermont is director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington-based policy group, and Joshua Meservey. He's senior policy analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. That's a think tank also based in Washington. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams, our favorite virtual platform, as we continue, yes, to practice social distancing to stem the spread of the coronavirus here in Washington. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us, Carol.
Thanks, Carol.
So let's start with the GERD, and Judd Devermont, over to you. This is this multi-billion-dollar Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam project. It's been a source of friction in the Nile River Basin ever since Ethiopia broke ground on it in 2011. Let's go back for a second and talk about the significance, both economically and culturally, Judd, of this dam for Ethiopia and the region.
Yeah, this dam is incredibly important to the Ethiopian project. It was started by former Prime Minister Meles and has been picked up by his two successors. The Ethiopians view the dam as the way to execute on their economic development plans. It's going to create, 6,000 megawatts of power, and that's critical for them if they want to transform their economy. And, one thing that's really interesting about this dam is that, yes, the government put a lot of money into it, but so did the Ethiopian people. The Ethiopian people contributed their own money to this project. And so the symbol of national pride, it's a symbol of Ethiopia's growing importance on the continent and its economic potential.
Over to you, Joshua. Sure, it's a symbol of Ethiopian national pride. It's probably extremely important for the economy. And yet, Egypt and Sudan, who were involved in the negotiations, have objections. How would you characterize their objections, and do you think they're justified?
Yeah, this is really, really difficult and complex because historically, despite the fact that the Blue Nile Basin, which provides about 85% of the water for the River Nile, and that Blue Nile Basin is fed by Lake Tana in Ethiopia. So despite the fact that Ethiopia historically has provided the great majority of water to the River Nile, it has benefited only from a tiny amount of using the water. Egypt has been a big beneficiary. So about 95% of the Egyptian population resides close to the Nile. It's the life stream, almost literally, of that country. So they have, I think, very legitimate concerns, Egypt and Sudan, because they are so dependent on the Nile. But the Ethiopians also have a legitimate gripe that the historic distribution of the water has not been particularly fair, and that they absolutely have a right to benefit from their fair share of the water. So that's, I think, part of the reason why the negotiations have dragged on for so long, why it appears that there's been so little progress on a few final sticking points, because there are legitimate concerns and arguments on both sides of this. You know, it's concerning that these negotiations have taken so long, because they have been trying for a long time now to hammer out these few final details. They just haven't been able to get over the hump. It's good that they remain committed to talking, but I do worry that because both sides have really legitimate positions on this, that neither side is willing to bend sufficiently in order to get to the negotiated agreement that's best for all the countries involved and the region.
So that leads us to the question, Judd Devermont, about the United States' involvement. Now that the United States is seen as, in a sense, putting its finger on the scale with threats to withhold approximately $130 million of foreign assistance to Ethiopia, this assistance comprises security assistance, military education and training, anti-human trafficking programs. But do you think this is a wise move on the part of the United States?
No, this couldn't be more counterproductive, Carol. The Egyptians have tried to entice the United States and also the World Bank at different points to negotiate this between Ethiopia and Egypt, in part because Ethiopia is at the source of the Nile and sort of has more of the cards to play. In previous administrations, the U.S. declined that role, in part because it was almost a lose-lose. Ethiopia and Egypt are important partners. And this is, as we've just kind of gone through, an incredibly sensitive, vital issue for both countries. But the Trump administration, at the request of al-Sisi, President Trump is very close to Egyptian leader al-Sisi, decided to negotiate. They appointed the Treasury as the key negotiator, and they did hammer out a deal. And, you know, credit where credit's deserved, the administration did make progress on a number of issues. But as they came around to February, the Ethiopians balked at the agreement. And since then, they've been at a standstill. And this $130 million threat only reinforces the Ethiopians' biggest fears that the U.S. was going to be favoring Egypt in the negotiations, that Egypt was perceived by the Ethiopians as a closer partner of the U.S., and so that they wouldn't get a fair shake. And so this breaks all the rules of diplomacy, do no harm. And the U.S. has really important interests in Ethiopia with this $130 million threat will undercut and undermine. We have important security relationships with Ethiopia. They're in the midst of an important transition that has kind of come off the rails a little bit. And we are sticking the bear in some respects. So I am very disappointed with this approach. And I think that it is short-sighted and counterproductive.
Josh Meservey, do you also see the U.S. move to withhold funds from Ethiopia at the request of Egypt as counterproductive? Do you fear that, you know, this will backfire?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that we're not sure yet if this indeed is going to happen, if it is a done deal, so to speak. We know recently that the Ethiopian ambassador to the United States stated publicly that he had reached out to the administration himself for clarity on this. So clearly nothing has been finalized. I do question the tactics of this because, as we've already been discussing, this issue of the GERD and the Nile more generally are almost existential issues for Ethiopia and Egypt. Ethiopia will not be dissuaded by a $130 million cut. I think maybe what this reflects is frustration from the administration, because as Judd referenced, the Ethiopians did balk and walk away from the U.S.-led negotiations, and there hasn't been much progress since then. But I'm all for putting pressure on various parties that are not being productive and are not engaging in good faith. I don't know if that's what's happening with the Ethiopians. I don't think so. But as a general rule, I'm all for pressure. But it has to be smart pressure. It has to be effective pressure. I just don't think 130 million is going to move the Ethiopians. In fact, it'll just antagonize them. So I hope that this perhaps is just being floated as a rumor and that nothing actually comes of it.
Can I just add to Josh's really important points, Carol? Because ultimately, what do we want? We want these two important countries to be at peace with each other. And what we don't want to do is to push one of them against the wall to feel like they have no other option but to go ahead unilaterally with either filling, which has started to happen with Ethiopia, or that the Egyptians feel that they have the backing from international partners to take whatever means necessary. I mean, a concern about a conflict between the two countries has been real for a very long time. And hopefully, as Josh said, that this is just rumor and it's not confirmed, but it adds to the sense of brinkmanship, I think. And that is exactly the opposite effect that we want.
Let's turn briefly to internal politics in Ethiopia. So back to you, Josh. There's been a great deal of civil unrest since the end of June, the killing of a popular Oromo singer and human rights defender. And just even today, Ethiopian authorities have been detaining dozens of opposition members and journalists for prolonged periods and often without charge. What's the status of this and how concerned are you, Josh, about this and also the postponement of national elections, originally due to COVID-19, but to what extent are you concerned about internal situation and stability?
I'm very, very concerned. Ethiopia should be of concern to anyone who cares about U.S.-Africa relations or just Africa in general. It's a hugely important country, and it's been in the midst of a very fragile transition, and the trajectory is negative. You referenced some of the unrest that has been going on. We're seeing bouts of very serious violence, both among ethnic groups or between ethnic groups, but also increasingly state-sponsored violence against particular ethnic groups, particularly the Oromo, which is the largest ethnic group in the country, but traditionally a marginalized one, even though the current prime minister is himself Oromo. So this is all very negative. It is a legacy in large part, I would say, of the dysfunctional, repressive regime that was replaced recently in Ethiopia by a revolution. But I'm not sure anyone understood how deep the wounds went from the decades-long repressive governance that country suffered. And unfortunately, the current government, for all of the great excitement and really wonderful and historic steps it took initially, and it has taken some of those steps, it now appears somewhat to be reverting to the previous regime's playbook. You referenced the incarceration of opposition figures. We're seeing mass arrests, people held incognito with no charges. Very, very concerning. Ethiopia is hugely fragile. It's hugely important. And I worry that the current government is not taking the proper steps to calm the inflamed tensions.
Judd, let me get to you for your response before we go to a break. In a previous program, you hailed Abiy Ahmed, the new prime minister, under this transition for postponing elections, or rather you said it was a wise decision. But what's your take on his rule so far? Do you think that he has not lived up to the types of reforms he wanted to introduce and is sort of falling back on the previous regime's playbook with respect to cracking down on press freedom and using severe tactics against journalists and others?
When we talked about Ethiopia last or two times ago, I talked about sort of what I thought was the merit in the delay, in part because he had consensus within the institutions and consensus within the parties. Many of the opposition parties weren't ready for elections anyway, and so they embraced this decision. But that was many months ago. And the next step would be to be transparent about when we are going to have elections or when, what are the steps that one needs to take. And Abiy has done none of those things. And it's exactly as Josh said, that he is at the helm of a very autocratic and repressive system. And it has been very easy for him to turn that on. And what's interesting is when he took power, what we did laud about Abiy is that he freed all of these dissidents. But those weren't his dissidents. Those were the dissidents of the preceding regime. Now, what he is doing is in opposition to him and his rule. Those are the folks that he's arresting. Those are the people who actually initially were his biggest supporters, like Jawar Mohammed and others. And to give you a sense of how increasingly isolated Abiy is and why we should be worried about the situation beyond just the number of arrests that he's had, the closing of civil space, the turning off of telecoms and social media for a brief period, is that his key mentor, former head of Oromo region, Lema, who became defense minister, they've had a falling out. So he is being increasingly an island onto his own. And so I am a co-chair of the Ethiopian Working Group, and we've put out a statement, you know, about our concern where Ethiopia is going. This was in early August, August 12th. We were deeply concerned about where Ethiopia was going, and we were really concerned also about the silence of the U.S. government, which has been very quiet. And just to connect, Carol, what we just said in the first part about GERD and this, these are not separate issues. If we are being heavy with them on the GERD, how do we have the bandwidth to also work on these transitional issues? So I think we're in a very dangerous spot with Ethiopia on a multitude of different issues. And Ethiopia failing is not just bad for Ethiopia. It's not just bad for the region. I think it's bad for, you know, U.S. and the global community's interests.
We'll certainly continue this conversation in a future program. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Joining me via Microsoft Teams are Judd Devermont, from whom you just heard. He's director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Joshua Mazurvi, senior policy analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. This is our periodic update on Africa, focusing on the GERD. And soon we'll be talking about Chinese spying on the continent. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to loyal Encounter listener and Facebook fan Tim's Bronx Nana J from Accra, Ghana. Once again, if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now to Joshua's paper on Chinese spying in Africa. Josh, as said in the introduction, you recently wrote a paper which concludes that Chinese companies have constructed or renovated at least 186 sensitive African buildings, which serve as vectors for Chinese spying. What are some of the key takeaways from your research, Josh? I'm curious also to know what percentage of countries are affected on the continent by the surveillance.
So this was a long-running project that was sparked by revelations back in 2018 in a French newspaper called Le Monde about how the African Union headquarters, which was constructed by a Chinese company, had microphones embedded in the walls and elsewhere, and the ICT system, which was installed by Huawei, was uploading its data every morning to Shanghai. So that sparked some curiosity, and I wondered how many other buildings like this had been constructed by Chinese companies. And as you referenced, I found at least 186 that had been renovated or constructed. And I say at least because it's very difficult to get information on these buildings for a whole host of reasons. So I know that there are more out there. I actually found mention of 60 other buildings that had been constructed by Chinese companies that I just couldn't confirm, and the original source wasn't solid enough for me to feel comfortable including it in the final number. So the key takeaways, I think, are just that, you know, this gives the Chinese Communist Party almost unprecedented surveillance access to Africa I do want to be clear here. I'm very careful about framing this as allegations because, you know, it's very hard to prove this sort of thing. By nature, it's covert. And I think it's a very likely bet that the Chinese Communist Party is using its access to these buildings to surveil Afghan governments and third parties. But I can't physically go and sweep the buildings myself for microphones or scan their ICT networks. But I think this is problematic for Afghan countries for a lot of obvious reasons. They constantly are negotiating with the Chinese government on loan terms and things of that nature, which, you know, if the Chinese government knew their negotiating strategy or position, that would be a huge advantage. Same thing for the U.S. government, where it's possible the Chinese Communist Party could be eavesdropping on conversations between senior American officials and their African counterparts. So there's a host of real potential problems for the United States and for African governments.
And Josh, before I turn to Judd for his reaction, are African leaders aware of this surveillance or alleged surveillance? And if so, what is their reaction?
My sense is that most African governments are probably not naive about the risks that come with accepting Chinese largesse. And it does appear from the data I gathered, most of these buildings are indeed gifts from the Chinese government. So I think that probably many of these African governments understand that, well, could well be the case that they are surveilling us through these secure governmental communications networks that Chinese companies have set up for a number of African governments. I think that there's a few things going on here. One is that some Afghan officials don't think they have anything that's really worth stealing. They feel as though the Chinese government, sure, they can surveil, but they're not going to get anything of use or importance, so it doesn't quite matter. Another issue here is that, unfortunately, the way China engages is at a very elite, senior most possible level, and it frequently lavishes their senior African partners with gifts, ranging from bribes to cash gifts that even help with supplying, you know, election material and things of that nature. So African officials are harshly incentivized to work with these Chinese entities.
And as we close, Judd Devermont, you get the last word. How concerned are you about the CCP surveillance? Previewing a paper that you wrote, which we'll discuss in a future program, to what extent does this affect U.S. policy and U.S. influence in the continent? If the Chinese are doing this, this certainly is meant to undermine U.S. influence with Africa and try to curry the favor of African countries, which would be very worrying for U.S. strategic interests.
Yeah, I think this is a phenomenal paper, and I think we owe a debt to Josh for putting all this together. It is tedious. We can't make accusations, but we can make some pretty good assumptions about what this means. And I think his explanation on why African countries are doing it makes a lot of sense to me. I'm going to just talk briefly about some of his conclusions because it nicely dovetails with some of the things that I'm saying in my recent paper. And one of them is that, you know, the U.S. government can do a better job talking to African countries about the risks and challenges and offering of services if they want to counter this. Or I think that we're going to be very hard pressed to convince them to turn down Chinese-built parliaments. And I don't see the U.S. or most countries really that interested in these kinds of buildings. But we can come up with a shared framework for how to think about these kind of buildings and offer services so they can create countermeasures to minimize Chinese spying. And that's kind of where I have landed on a U.S. policy towards Africa with respect to China. Now, the paper is much broader than that, and I think it's been one of the faults of this current administration to be so focused on China. They do present threats, but the U.S. has to be about what we do and what we offer. And when it comes to malign interest, we need to work with our partners to come up with a shared sense of principles, values, and frameworks for how we do investments, how we and our Chinese counterparts and Russian counterparts and whoever, and then hold those different partners account for that, both the African partners and the Chinese or other partners. And I think it's a much more effective way for us to rise above the fray and not get into this tit for tat, zero sum approach, but also to be quite honest about what we think are the threats that are posed by Chinese companies and lead by example. We, the U.S., are willing to undergo a due diligence exercise for our companies and how they invest. And we look to our African partners to help set the terms or at least share terms about how we engage. And that's not what the Chinese do most of the time, in particular, as Josh said, when they're offering these things as gifts. You know, beware of people offering gifts.
We'll certainly be looking forward to focusing on your paper titled A New U.S. Policy Framework for the African Century in a future program. But for now, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Judd Debermont, Director of the Africa Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and Joshua Meservey, Senior Policy Analyst for Africa and the Middle East at the Heritage Foundation. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.